Hello and welcome to this podcast from Don't Forget the Bubbles. If you enjoy our podcasts, please tell your colleagues and subscribe on iTunes and Spotify. Enjoy. Hello and welcome to Don't Forget the Bubbles podcast. I'm hosting today. My name's Ian Lewins, PM consultant from Derby. And this is our second episode of the Three Musketeers. I've got to get a jingle for this at some stage. And I'm really pleased to be joined by Drs. Damien Rowland and Dr. Alistair Munro, who are going to join me today to sort of have a chat about things COVID-y and some recent papers and controversies. Morning, Damien. How are you?
I'm very well, thanks. Thank you very much for the invite. Looking forward to discussion, debate, and maybe a bit of rib tickling as well.
Excellent. And the musical finale, I presume you've practiced.
Definitely. I'm all over it.
Excellent. Good. And Alistair, good morning. How are you, apart from very tired?
Yes, I'm good, thanks. I'm a little bit apprehensive now. I've heard there might be rib tickling involved, but yeah, otherwise looking forward to having a good discussion.
Okay. So one of the suggestions, so we've got some papers to discuss, some things to chat about, and the framework that we're going to use is a Dr. Rowland trademark, which is to use the acronym COVID, C-O-V-I-D, to have a think through some issues with regards to communication, organisations, vital signs, interventions, and dilemmas, and we'll maybe have a chat around those sorts of things. So let's start with C. Let's start with communication. And I think, Damien, that the paper that you'd brought to our attention is very, very strong on issues of communication.
Yeah, so, I mean, this is, I find, quite frankly, amazing. It's not really a published article. It's more of a statement. It's from the American Academy of Pediatrics. It's called COVID-19 Interim Guidance, Return to Sports. And the reason this caught my eye is because I've been following some of the debate about myocarditis. And I think, Ali, actually, can I just, what's happened with this? So that there seem to be some publications suggesting that lots of people were getting myocarditis, even if they weren't symptomatic. And this may be a big problem.
Quite a bit of stuff's happened with it. It's been a bit of a roller coaster. There was an initial paper in JAMA Cardiology that seemed to show quite a high proportion of inpatients with COVID-19 had signs of myocarditis compared to both like healthy normal people, but then risk factor matched controls. As it turned out, the data in the paper was all completely wrong. So no one's entirely sure what happened with the data, but the numbers were completely wrong, and it was picked up because basically there were sort of impossible distributions of the data in the tables that didn't make any sense. So anyway, the paper was revised really quickly, and they changed the data. And as it turned out, once the actual data was input, there was no longer a statistically significant difference in the features of myocarditis between the patients with COVID and the risk factor matched controls. So there was a difference between healthy people, but if you took people with all the same comorbidities as the patients with COVID, suddenly the statistically significant differences
essentially
disappeared.
It's really interesting. Go on, sorry.
Yeah, I mean, there's just been loads of stuff since then. I mean, there was a paper that looked at some post-mortem cardiac findings that, you know, showed evidence of, you know, myocarditis and viral invasion. And then there's been a few uncontrolled studies looking at cardiac MRI in, you know, healthy people who have had COVID. And then they find these enhancements on MRI, but the people have completely normal troponins and normal CRPs. And so it's split opinions, really, because there's one group of people who have gone, oh, hey, look, there's bright images on an MRI. We need to be super cautious. and then another group of people going, well, we have absolutely no idea what that means, if anything at all, and the blood tests are normal. We still don't really know how to interpret this type of imaging because it's completely new. And so there's a lot of fear on one end and a lot of skepticism on the other end, really, based on these sort of slurry of papers that have come out in the past few weeks.
I like your description of a slurry of papers.
Thank you. Yeah.
As a sort of not, you guys are far more involved in research than me. Is this a good time to be involved in research with COVID, or is this an absolutely dreadful time? Because there seems to be a lot of papers that get rapidly published and then people go, hang on, this is nonsense.
I mean, I personally say, from some respects, it's an amazing time to be involved in research because there's so much interest in research at the moment. So let's ignore the fact that some of it's utterly rubbish. The fact that there's a lot of public engagement, there's a lot of on the shop floor, people talking about stuff, I think it's really good just for getting people thinking about the academic process and critical appraisal. So I suppose with my Perukian academic educator hat on, it's brilliant. The flip side is, and I'm guilty of this myself, it is so much easier now to get turgid research published. And that is a real challenge and is causing confusion for everyone involved.
And this goes back to sort of communication, I guess, in that now that the world and his dog are experts in public health and virology, that people will pick up on tiny little bits and use it to prove what they thought in the first place.
Unfortunately, and that's exactly what is happening. And I think one of the things that might be good about this is a real drive now for everyone to understand, and I'm including kind of clinicians and academics and the public, in that the world isn't black and white, and the media are obsessed with black and white, and that is just not how things work.
Yeah, I think that's been a really strong feature recently, because there's such a dual-edged sword to the public engagement in the research, because terrible research is being published all the time and was being published before COVID. But the problem is now, if you publish terrible research, or if, you know, you publish a paper and you grossly over-egg the significance of it in your conclusions, that makes headlines now, and suddenly it directs policy. So that the original JAMA cardiology paper was thought to be responsible for some of the huge American sports leagues cancelling their seasons on the fear that they might have participants with myocarditis who might be at risk if they went and played football. And, you know, the engagement is great because, as Damien said, people are having to think about science in a way that they never did before and are being really engaged. But it does mean that the sort of hogwash that used to come out and just be ignored for all eternity suddenly comes out, and people who don't already have the expertise to appraise the significance of research, and particularly when it's just single papers, suddenly the way that gets implemented or what people draw from it is quite often a lot more than it should be. And Damien's exactly right that it all gets made very black and white, and it gets made into, you know, catchy headlines, when we all know that it often requires a lot more careful consideration than it's often given.
Yeah, but in your sort of article, Damien, we're not talking about a small organisation. We're talking about the AAP.
Oh yeah, I mean this is huge. This is the kind of the American equivalent of the RCPCH. So we're talking about a big organisation that directs pediatric care in the United States. And so what's amazing is they start off with some not unreasonable statements saying that there are some children who have had severe presentations. So perhaps the inflammatory syndrome, and some of these children have required intubation, have had kidney or cardiac failure. And it seems not unreasonable that if you've had some evidence of cardiac damage, you should probably think about how you go back to exercise. And they've suggested that restricting exercise and participation for 3 to 6 months, that might seem extreme, but I can kind of see where they're coming from. But then further down, And I'm going to read this out because it just amazes me. The main question still remains about what to do with others infected with SARS who had close contact with an individual with COVID-19. Who had close contact. So they're saying you may have had SARS but with no symptoms, or that you've just had close contact. Because of the growing literature about the relationship between COVID-19 and myocarditis, and I think as Ali's explained, I think that literature is not clear cut, all children or adolescents with exposure to SARS-CoV-2, regardless of symptoms, require a minimum 14-day resting period and must be asymptomatic for more than 14 days before returning to exercise and or competition. And I just find that incredible. What it is saying is that any child with any form of symptoms needs to do 2 weeks off sport. And actually, the risks are not, there's no evidence that the children are going to come to harm. And what we're doing is we're stopping children doing the things that they need to do to keep themselves both physically and mentally healthy. And I don't understand how a child health organization would be putting those risks out. And the only thing I can think of, and I'd be very happy to receive any backlash from America's listeners to this, is from a protective insurance-based process rather than really putting the needs of the child first.
I mean, that was my reading of it. That was my thoughts on it, is surely there's a litigation somewhere sitting there that this is trying to defend against, almost, because, you know, there's some, as you say, there are some really good bits in this, but when we're talking about communication and the age that we're in at the moment, this is the one where you go, wow, okay, and there's the headline.
It's just I don't really know what to make of it, to be honest. There's been lots of stuff where I've seen poor quality debate, but I understand that someone's taking an evidence viewpoint and trying to apply it maybe through their own lens, whereas this doesn't seem to apply the correct lens for the problem that is being trying to be mitigated against. I'd love to get some further feedback on this from those kind of who are living and working in America to find their feelings on it.
I mean, what I don't understand is what there's the need to issue guidance at all on the topic where absolutely no evidence exists at all for children, in this arena. It comes back to sort of a broader point about guidelines. Really, we all in the medical community seem to feel a need to issue benchmarks or guidelines for things, when quite often no one really has any idea what they're doing. And as soon as you draw that line in the sand, you've created a stick with which medical legal people can beat doctors with if it's not adhered to. And I agree with Damien in terms of like the hyperinflammatory syndrome and stuff like that. Myocarditis is a big feature of that, and it seems really reasonable to just urge caution in some way. But for to say children who have not had any symptoms or even have been confirmed to have COVID but may have been exposed, I'm just not sure what the impetus was or who was asking for guidelines about returning to sport for these kids. And the flip side is that I feel like there's really no consideration of the balance of risks and harms here. Like, I think there was a lot of concern about, during social restrictions and stuff, how much exercise and activity children have been having and what the long-term consequences of that are. We know that particularly in the US and the UK as well, that childhood obesity is a major, major issue. You know, there's going to be serious life years lost as a result of that before even COVID. And if we're now talking about restricting children who may have had exposure, from activity for a period of time, it just seems like the risks and benefits of that have not been considered, or if they have, it's not evident in the guideline.
No. And I think I read, but as well as you've got to have your 14 days off, you also need to be cleared by a physician before you start exercising again, I think.
Yeah, I know. I put something in. I put a quick tweet about this. I just imagine being the doctor looking after this child who's brought into your office. I was just thinking, what is going? Why are you here? What am I supposed to do to clear? You never had any symptoms. You never felt unwell. Like, what do I do to make you more okay to go back into sport than you were before?
I mean, I think I'd argue the only thing, I think, whether they've amended this, but I think they do say those with moderate symptoms must be asymptomatic for at least 14 days and obtain clearance from their primary care physician. So I think it's not the group who have just had contact. I think they are trying to say that you've had something. But even then, as you say, Ali, they've not been positive. So you've got this weird consultation that of a patient arriving saying, I had some symptoms which may or not have been related to COVID. I'm now symptom free. What would you like me to do, family physician or GP? And the family physician or GP is going to go, just start doing exercise again. Yeah. It's weird. Really weird.
Yeah. And it's, you know, this is sort of moving on slightly to the O with the organisations. It's now this has come from the AAP. I guess primary physicians in America are going to be looking at this and thinking, oh, you know, blimey, do I need to follow this? Am I going to be liable if, God forbid, something happens with somebody who's, you know, say moderately symptomatic? It'd be interesting to see if there's any similar response or guidance from other organisations. And as you say, I can't imagine for one second the RCPCH going to issue anything similar anytime soon.
Well, they'll do what Ali suggests is not issue, not even consider it, because it's not an issue. Let's not create work where we don't need it.
Yeah. Okay. Let's move on then. Anything else from your perspective, Damien, about organisations in this paper?
So not really. I mean, I think just from an organisational context, the thing, and we're not going to come to any conclusions here. The thing that is filling my inbox in discussion is we've had for a period of time, for I think very good reason, splitting departments into asymptomatic and symptomatic cohorts to try and prevent spread. As we move into winter and get busier, that just becomes increasingly difficult to do. If you're in a position where you've got a big department, it's not a disaster because you can move things around. But even then, it does constrain what you can achieve, and it does cause problems for kind of staff skill mix and deployment. If you're a smaller department, it's just a disaster. So a lot of people are discussing, do going forward, we really need to keep departments split. Now, I'll admit to a bit of a bias. We just published something from Leicester, and I'll be clear, this was only for patients who were admitted. So we don't really know what the magnitude of COVID positivity is. But in over 10,500 patients, only 22 of them were positive that we tested for, and there was no spread within the department. There's similar, I think, feeling throughout the community. And I think it's your department, Ali, have decided that you're not going to split just on the basis of symptoms. You're going to split on the basis of when you get admitted. Is that right?
Yeah, so we've just gone back to a single footprint. We're lucky in the fact that this is easier because we have cubicles for our acute area. So we don't have any bays in our acute assessment area. So it's felt to be much lower risk to be mixing, you know, so-called blue and red patients, because ideally you don't have to expose any of them. So we've got like a little observation and play area where we don't put anyone who would have usually been allocated red. But yeah, we're back in a single footprint.
Yeah, I mean, what are we doing? So we've got red side and a green side, which are sort of split, but organisationally it's been really challenging because red side to get to X-ray, I've got to walk through the green side. And although we've got red and green X-ray, there's still going to be a footfall across both sides. And it's meant that we've had to temporarily close our observation unit and use that as sort of green side where we're seeing people. So it is challenging, and you know, winter's not even really started to hit yet. And I think once bronchiolitis season comes upon us, I am fascinated as to what we do, whether we sort of continue to try and do that, or whether we go, this just isn't feasible. What we've done is, for inpatients, split the wards, so a red side and a green side, which we can physically keep distanced. But in the ED itself, it is incredibly difficult.
I think the big problem is going to be as well is surge capacity, because I think most emergency department, well, kids' emergency departments during winter end up with just waiting rooms awash with a mix of hot, yeah, snotty, vomiting children with ankle injuries and all this other stuff. And the problem is, once you've exceeded your bed capacity and you've got a waiting area of any description, you've sort of, unless you've got capacity for two waiting areas that can handle that type of burden, you've really lost the benefit of segregating beds wise. So I think that's going to be when the crunch really comes, is when we're pushed out of, you know, the beds or cubicles, and we've got people in corridors and in chairs and on, you know, on the walls and ceilings and everywhere else. Yeah. When have you lost any benefit of segregating, and when does it, you know, become actually less risky to just bung everyone in all together where you can manage flow better?
Yeah, it's managing risk, and actually we're not quite sure what the risk you're managing against is, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and I think the challenge for a number of departments is that there are staff who work in children's emergency care who have been deemed through their risk assessments to try and avoid coming into contact with COVID. Now, in children's, that's been relatively easy because we've just not had the COVID load, but we don't know how that's going to change over the couple of months. And just redeploying everyone back together into one big mix isn't always an easy solution as well. My personal feeling is what is going to be different about this winter than previous winters is public expectation. And that as we get into the busier October, November period, where we commonly have completely full waiting rooms, is whether the public will accept the fact that things are crowded. And previously they've accepted it because they've known that the health system has been overwhelmed. And while they may have been uncomfortable about it, that they've probably just kept themselves to themselves. My worry is for the poor departments where the public start taking photos, sharing them with the media, etc. And I think that will make things uncomfortable. And I hope staff don't feel under pressure because of that, because I can see some families getting quite upset with the situation, and staff are not going to be able to do anything about it.
I think the other consideration is as well, what a position I hope we weren't going to be in, but, you know, cases are rising nationally of COVID, and hospitalizations are increasing, and there's clearly not an attitude, an appetite for hardcore lockdowns again. And so I do wonder if hospitals are going to end up quite full, you know, of patients with COVID in one way or another, and whether that's going to have a similar effect to what it did before, and people being more hesitant to come to hospital or other redirection efforts. I mean, it's going to be an interesting winter one way or another, I think.
I love your use of the word interesting there. I mean, you know, as we all experienced over sort of lockdown, EDs across the country, the attendance, you know, dropped off a cliff, down 50% in a lot of places. I cannot see that happening if there is a second lockdown in this country, that people won't attend, because I think that, I don't know what you guys think, but I think there was a genuine sort of fear at that time of coming to hospital. And I think that potentially that fear factor is diminishing rapidly, and that we won't see what we saw in March and April.
I'll just get quickly on my soapbox. One of the things that I don't think that we've done yet nationally, although I am working with a load of people to try and do this at least locally, is that one of the messages before was you must attend kind of ED, we're open, but we didn't celebrate the really good decisions that parents and carers made. We were in lockdown for a long period of time, and yes, there were some isolated, tragic cases of children not being brought to the emergency department when perhaps they should have been. But these were very small numbers. And in fact, what we should be doing now is saying, look, parents and carers, you did an amazing job in managing minor illness and injury for 6 months. Let's help you do that for the next 6 months when we really need you to do it. Because as you say, Ian, we are going to be kind of crowded and overwhelmed. And now is the time to applaud the great decision making that was made.
Yeah, that's a very valid point. Let's sort of move on slightly with COV, V for vital signs. Alistair, what's your paper you've brought to sort of have a chat about?
So I'm going to do something very unusual now, and I'm going to talk about something that isn't directly related to COVID. So I hope you're hanging on to your seats as we quickly veer direction and talk about what was one of my favourite topics until about 6 or 7 months ago, and that I haven't really thought about much since then. But it's essentially about risks of children with fever coming to the emergency department, risks of them having serious or invasive infections, and the utility of the types of screening tools or screening criteria that we commonly use to try and risk stratify. And it's really an observational study from one of the big paediatric emergency departments in London, looking at all of the children who came in with a measured fever or whose presenting problem was, you know, logged as being fever, looking at their outcomes and, you know, looking how many of them triggered different warning signs and stuff like that. Now, I love this type of paper because it's, in some ways, it's really simple and it's just not done enough, because what we really want to know when we're managing these children is what is the risk of any given child coming in, you know, with a particular presentation. What is the risk that they've got the thing I'm really, really worried about? And that's been really hard to ascertain from the literature, actually, over the past few years. There were some good studies done decades ago, but we've had complete revolutions in the vaccination schedule, which is, you know, almost completely eradicated HIB and has reduced the incidence of meningococcal disease and stuff. And so really getting a good handle on, you know, we all get a feeling that not many of these kids are very sick, but it's been really hard to put numbers on them. And I think that's one of the great things about this paper. So they had about just over 5,000 children in this cohort who came with a fever of some description. And then of those, they looked in more detail at the children who would have triggered a sort of a red flag sign in some way. So either in the nice warning signs, nice warning, you know, the traffic light system or one of the other sort of red flag systems. So they had about 1,600 of these kids who had a fever and then, you know, had some sort of red flag sign. And of these, over 1,600 kids who had a fever and, you know, warning signs, the incidence of any invasive infection, so bacteremia, meningitis, whatever, was 0.4%. So of the most high, of the group of kids we consider most high risk with having fever, it was only one in 250 actually had, you know, an invasive infection. And then, you know, there was handfuls more who had UTIs and pneumonias and stuff like that, which hopefully are a little bit worrisome and a bit easier to pick up. But I mean, the headline really from the paper was looking at the things like the observations and warning scores and stuff, and they just perform so badly, because I think the incidence of this stuff is so rare, it's so hard for any you know, scoring system or anything based on physiological values like heart rate and respiratory rate to really be of any use. So that was the sort of, the headline was these scores are not very good. We need to have a think about what we're doing.
Yeah, and it's I agree with you. I think talking about risk is really interesting. And, you know, when I have sort of medical students that accompany me and they want me to go, this is the diagnosis, this is what I do. And actually, a lot of the time, what I'm doing is simply, well, not simply, but is risk managing. And it's this concept of what do you take as an acceptable risk? And I know, Damien, this is something you've thought about a lot before, is, you know, what is acceptable risk to a healthcare professional may be totally different as an acceptable risk to parents. And that's something that we've not really sort of looked at so far.
No, I mean, it's actually an amazing gap in both the literature and our personal practice. Now, there's a few groups beginning to work on this, but I think it amazes me that we didn't sort this kind of a decade ago, is that for any given child who presents, the dissonance between a clinician looking at a child and going, okay, the risk of this happening is this. If I don't do anything, the risk of this happening is this, and this is why I'm making that decision. But what, while we talk safety netting to parents, we don't really engage with them a lot in understanding their level of risk. Now, I try and do that in all the consultations where I do review, and a lot of my decision-making isn't always based on the exact clinical criteria a patient has, i.e. their heart rate, their respiratory rate, but it's more to do the understanding that a parent or carer has in why I'm making that decision and what might happen if I've either got things right or got things wrong. And that dialogue is critical, because when mistakes do happen, and they always will do, it's that shared understanding of why we're doing what we're doing that helps the fallout afterwards. And I think it amazes me that we don't have more on this particular topic.
Yeah. So, okay. So if you're chatting about risk, how do you phrase that? Do you talk about numbers to parents, or is it sort of getting their understanding of what the risks are of sending home versus doing potentially unnecessary interventions, et cetera?
Yeah. So, I actually personally try and avoid numbers because, yeah, one, I don't know them well enough, I suppose, myself. And I also, I think it's a bit harsh on the parent in an acute situation where they're worried about their child to try and bamboozle them, really. What I do try and explain, though, is the reason that I've reached a decision where I think that child is safe to go home and my reasons for doing that, but also clearly explaining there is a number of possibilities of things that might happen in the next 24 hours or the next couple of days. And I explain what those things might be and what are the criteria for returning over what time period. And it's that time period that's quite important. And what I'm looking for is the parent's or carer's response to that. The reason being is it's interesting is that if you have a child who is an infant, let's say 3 to 4 weeks, with a fever, a lot of them actually can be relatively unwell with a serious bacterial illness. And I'm defining that as you culture something, which is slightly different from an invasive bacterial illness where you know that there's been an impact for that illness. But actually, those children have quite a bit of time to sometimes return, so that even if you do miss something, they're not suddenly going to collapse. The real challenge comes with what, in my belief, it's group A strep, where you have a 3.5-year-old who presents 1 minute, maybe completely well, and 6 hours later, maybe moribund. And so there's a difference in terms of the advice I give for what I think the infections might be. And it's about understanding what the parent and carer is going to accept in terms of when they might need to come back and the mechanism by which they are going to pick up on signs and symptoms. But it's still, I wish I had more evidence to support some of my rationale behind this.
So this is, you know, the principle of good safety netting, and it's trying to explain, this is my expectation of this illness, that this is highly likely to be viral, for example, and this is my expectation of what will happen over the next few days, and here's when I'm worried, and here's the things that would concern me, and here's the things that you would need to, when you would need to come back. And I guess it's sort of being very explicit about that. So you're not really sort of saying, yeah, as you say, you're not talking numbers, here's the risk of X, Y, and Z. But it's sort of saying, here's why I'm not worried, here's what I would be worried about, and empowering parents to sort of use that information. Is that sort of roughly what you're saying?
Yeah, and the other thing is context, and this is what I try and explain to my juniors all the time. My decision-making process may be completely different on a Monday morning compared to a Sunday afternoon for the same child with the same symptoms. The reason being is on a very busy Sunday afternoon, where a Sunday evening where I'm cognitively overloaded because of all the patients there, I worry about my decision-making process. So I may either err on the side of caution, or I may have been given the ability, because it's been so overcrowded, that the patient's already been observed for 4 to 6 hours in the department, yeah. So I can be more confident. If you pitch up on a Monday morning and actually there's very few people in the department, I don't have any trajectory of illness to go on, so I might make a different decision because the information and the context of that decision is different. And that's really difficult to teach, but I think it also explains why sometimes juniors get frustrated. Well, why did Dr. Rowland make this decision now, but a couple of weeks ago he made a completely different one, but the patient was the same? But that context is absolutely critical.
Yeah, and I think that's something that does frustrate trainees, doesn't it? Is that,
and it frustrates parents as well, because yeah, I think they see sometimes the same thing happening.
Yeah, this is the art of it, isn't it, as well as just the science. This is why, you know, this person managed it this way and this person's got exactly the same patient and has managed it entirely differently. And as you say, context is really important. Anything else that you took away from the paper, Ali?
I think just it highlights the really difficult position we're in now in paediatrics, a really fortunate position, but a really difficult one, where we sort of sell ourselves as, you know, our main job is being to find these kids, these really rare kids who are really, really sick, and to save them. And when, you know, we've sort of, because of the success of vaccinations and that sort of stuff, we've put ourselves in a really impossible situation where the haystack is bigger than it's ever been. And there's fewer needles, but the pressure to find the needles is really, really high. And we keep trying to come up with scoring systems or other things to help. And I think there needs to be a bit of an appreciation of quite what a complex problem this is, and that there aren't any simple solutions. And I think perhaps, hopefully, this paper could serve as a springboard for talking about, well, you know, what are the potential downsides of, you know, doing all of these scores and all these tools and other things for all of these kids when the success rate of them is so low. You know, are we creating alarm fatigue? Are we creating a distraction? Is this just additional paperwork without benefiting? You know, where can we redirect our efforts? And I do think that, training people in providing good safety net advice and helping parents to understand that, you know, when we send them home, it's because they look fine now, at the point that I'm sending them home, but that we recognize that the trajectory of illness changes over a period of time, and it's always, we think that they're fine now, but you know, it's up to the parent to see how things change over the next few days. And particularly because I think we all appreciate, as Damien said, that for the really serious infections, for bacterial sepsis and stuff, the decline can be so rapid that it's making parents feel really comfortable in a decision to come back. And so that's something that I always highlight is, you know, if anyone's ever, I always say, if anyone is at home having a conversation saying, oh, the doctor said he was fine, I don't want to waste anybody's time, that is the point at which you should be coming back in. If anyone's concerned enough to have that conversation, then just come back. And yeah, I think making parents feel comfortable to come back when things change or if things change is key.
Yeah. I think one of the things I say to parents is, you know, highlighting, here's why I'm not worried. Here are the things that I'd be worried about. Here's what I can and can't see, which make me comfortable about them going home. And you're not for one second saying your child's perfectly well. And I do talk a bit about the difference between the phrase I use is poorly versus sick. So poorly being you feel under the weather, you feel rotten, you've got a temperature, but you'll get over it yourself, versus sick is somebody needs to help me make this child better. and I do talk in terms of, you know your child better than I ever, ever will do. And if you were, you know, you're comfortable that this is what poorly looks like, if you think that child has changed from poorly to sick, then you come back straight away. And I think many people do sort of something very similar. Let's move on then to interventions. Anybody got any interventions they want to talk about at the moment?
I mean, I don't think there's anything new that has massively emerged in the literature in the last couple of months since we last spoke that is a game changer for kind of emergency medicine or acute pediatric research. There's a couple of interesting discussion points. I don't think we should go through it now, but Nate Cooperman and his team in PKAN in America, a byproduct of the big DKA study they did, was looking at cognitive decline following having an episode of DKA. And they I think they've got some preliminary evidence that there is evidence of a deterioration. And I think it's just a good example of, I know we debate a lot about, okay, should we give loads of fluids or not? Does that cause cerebral edema? One of the underlying things is we need to get DKA under control, both in the before it happens, so we stop it happening, or as quickly as possibly can, because there clearly is some effect of it happening. And I think I need to spend a bit more time looking at the paper. But I think in the same way that we've been late to the game in looking at concussion in head injury, and some of the ongoing support we need for that, I wonder if we're going to need to start doing that for DKA as well.
Yeah. Let's move on then to the last letter D, dilemmas, and I guess the paper, or the letter that I've brought, highlights some of the dilemmas. So this is a letter that was written to archives in June of this year by a team in London, looking at they describe the rising incidence of abusive head trauma during the pandemic, and you know we. During lockdown, with this sort of significant decline in attendance, and that the question of where have all the poorly kids gone, that sort of raised multiple times. I guess what this letter was trying to do was highlight that there, you know, whilst lockdown may be important, actually there are significant potential unintended consequences of that. And essentially, what this paper did was it. Looked at the sort of the instance of abusive head trauma during the month of end of March to the end of April when we're in the UK, we were in lockdown, and showed, you know, from their data, a really significant increase in the cases of abusive head trauma. However, as Damien pointed out before the podcast, there are some issues with this. Do you want to explain what they might have been, Damien?
Yeah, so I mean, I think. So it's really difficult, and I don't want to be guilty of kind of taking on other researchers' piece of work without a right to reply. Yeah. And I think anything during COVID that examined the incidence of particular events is important. And I've done and published that work myself. So I think this was an important piece of research because there was a real feeling that safeguarding could be an issue and that children may come to harm because of lockdown. So there's nothing wrong with this type of research. And what the group did was just look at all the children who presented with abusive head trauma to a particular institution, which was Great Ormond Street, over a period of time and compare that with the previous 3 years. Nothing wrong with that. What they found was a 1,493% increase. Now,
that's very specific, Damien. That's a very specific amount of increase.
Yeah. And I suppose that's my point. It just, there was something about it that immediately rings, well, isn't that a bit weird? I mean, it was only 10 children anyway was yeah. seen during this time period. So I'm really sorry, it's just alarmist. The structure of presenting the results in that way, I don't think was hugely, again, I'm trying not to be disparaging against other researchers, but was just too blunt and was not but with a couple of limitations. And my understanding was is that because of the system change in London during that time period, only Great Ormond Street was seeing these type of patients. So an increase was almost inevitable. But I'm waiting to have confirmation on that. And I suppose my flag waving is not about, please do this type of research, it's really important, but there is a public context to it. And this paper has an op matrix of 352. It's been picked up by 28 news outlets. And I think we have a responsibility just to be balanced in our approach.
Yeah, because the thing that struck me about this, and it's, as you said, it's got a lot of traction, sort of Twitter and the media. The thing that struck me was this was seemed to be totally contrary to what we were seeing locally, in that the number of referrals to social care, the number of child protection medicals locally seemed to plummet. And that was really concerning to say, where have all the children who have sustained non-accidental injury gone? And actually that was far more of a worry, that actually they are not being brought to the attention of social care and health services.
Yeah, and agree. And actually, that's why I think this type of research is really important, because we need to understand those processes. And I've been quite vocal about kind of this concept of delayed presentations not being as significant as people were led to believe. But I am utterly convinced that the community harm, or the harm that's occurred that didn't need acute attention, is almost certainly going to have occurred and is still a ticking time bomb to see the net result of it. And so I think the safeguarding and understanding that the problems of chronic conditions, yes, please get out there, let's have a look at this and let's understand it. But again, the context is absolutely critical.
Absolutely. Ali, any other sort of dilemmas that you've come across at all?
Not affecting acute paediatric care at the moment. I think all the dilemmas are coming in the next few weeks. Although, just a big shout out to Rhinovirus. I just want to give a big thank you to Rhinovirus for completely ruining the last month of everyone's life in the children's emergency department. I mean, I don't know about anyone else, but I was not prepared for that level of rapid rise in presentation of hot, wheezy children. And it's just, it's funny. It's been, for anyone who's interested, it's been seen elsewhere as well in many other European countries. And it happened in Australia over their winter as well, even though their lockdowns completely eradicated their flu season. They had almost no flu at all. Rhinovirus just came to center stage. And I've just been really enjoying that over the past few weeks. So yeah, respect to the rhino.
Absolutely, yeah. Gents, I think we will wrap it up there. That's been really interesting. Damien, I love the framework. You need to make sure you patent that ASAP.
Thank you. I will do. I'm on it now.
Somebody will steal it otherwise. But that's been a really interesting chat about what's happening at the moment in the world of sort of acute and emergency paediatrics. I hope you found it useful, and we must do it again sometime. Thank you for taking the time to listen to this podcast from Don't Forget the Bubbles. Remember, you can subscribe to our feed on iTunes and Spotify. Thank you for listening.